Accession number 9145, rule number 5.
Mr. Shobbage, take 5. But you hadn't really told me what your daily activity as troops would have been there. Did you, for instance, have parades
No.
and drills?
No.
Or did you have tasks to do
No.
in Omsk, you know, delivering stores or...
No.
So what did you No. do with yourselves, apart from visit these ladies and go to the yacht clubs?
Well, actually, during the day... We really had nothing to do with either play cards. We played a lot of bridge. That's the old-fashioned auction, not contract. It wasn't in existence then. Just mooned about.
Had you any idea where the Bolshevik forces were, where the Red forces were, regarding their proximity to Omsk?
No. Because I think there must have been 2 regiments went up to Murmansk, right upon the Russian border, while we were down this end. We had no contact whatsoever, direct or indirect, with... Well, at least we were unaware of that. There was only now just realized one little incident which could have passed quite unnoticed, that the engines was fired by wood, and they had over the funnel this sort of wire cage thing. And I think it must have been on the journey from Omsk to Ekaterinburg that we had an officer who was fluent Russian. The train began to slow, and this particular officer knew there was no stop scheduled for there, and he went to investigate, and it appears there was somebody got onto the engine and was threatening the driver to stop, but we didn't stop, and whether he was just politely told to jump off and that, but that's the only minor incident that we can think of.
Did you find that the trains, you know, you mentioned the Trans-Siberian Railway, which of course you would have used from Vladivostok,
yes,
wouldn't you, right,
yes,
through to Ekaterinburg?
Oh, yes.
Did you find that was relatively intact and efficient?
Oh, no, because we were travelling in what would normally be on an English line, cattle trucks. But they were subdivided. Now, in the middle of the carriage, you had these stoves with a funnel going through the roof. And from this south, you got planks, say 6 inches from the floor this end and 9 to 12 inches from the floor that end, so that you were sleeping on the slope, and you used your part of your uniform for your pillows, as it were. And in the mornings, you know, you hung your coats up all the way round the but to get your coat off in the morning, you went over to your coat and you grabbed it with this hand. You put your foot up against the wall of the crud and tear it off, and it would just come out as a solid block. You see, well, then you beat it on the ground until it got some sort of life to it, and your fire would be going pell-mell, as it were. And you'd then, each in turn, would try to thaw out your thing round the... Now, funnily enough, the funnel from the fire, you could have it nearly red hot one side but stone cold the other. And it very much reminded me of an ice factory that I once visited in Cheltenham, that half the pipe was frosted outside and the front part was quite hot. It was where the draft was blowing over the ammonia and getting the you get ice blocks there the size of that mantle surround. But the interior of the we used to sleep fairly warm because of the fire we got in the and you put a bucket of water by the side of it, but you always put a big lump of wood on the top, let it float on the top, otherwise it would have frozen over.
Did you ever have cases of frostbite with the troops?
No, the nearest the nearest I come to frostbite was, we were walking three abreast down the main street in Omsk, and all of a sudden a Russian gentleman stepped off the pavement and come right over and up with a thing and smashed me on the face like this. He'd spotted my nose turning white just there like that.
And he rubbed it with snow?
Pardon?
He rubbed it with snow, did he?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's a sign of frostbite, is it, when your nose turns right?
White. Oh, yes.
Yes.
Yes, and it doesn't stop there. It would gradually creep. Because one of our chaps got frostbite in his fingers, and he had to go to the medico every morning, and he would split it up like there, each of his fingers.
Well, cut it.
Yeah, so that the water could drain off. And then he'd bind it up again, and the next day the same similar thing would happen. But one thing you had to be particularly careful of course, on the carriages, you had iron handles, like you would when they draw the things on the cattle truck. Well, I was getting in the carriage one day and I grabbed one of these. Instead of putting my hand inside the door like any normal bloke would, I caught hold of the handle and drew myself into the car, and I couldn't let go with this hand. And I had to ease it off like that, gently, where it got stuck like a burn. Oh, it is. Mind you, it's a magnificent country, but...
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the scenery. You know, we're talking about Siberia.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is a place of exile, isn't it?
A traditional
place of Russian exile.
You've got a photograph of a Russian prison there. That, you could go. And yet, in the summer, it's more or less like an English summer.
Was it a beautiful country? Was it lovely to look at?
Yes and no. Now, for instance, when we were at Ekaterinburg, in our billet, you could stand outside the door and read a paper by moonlight. You got the reflection of the aurora borealis. They called it the midnight sun. And so it was. You could read an ordinary newspaper midnight outside.
Before I go on to Ekaterinburg, you mentioned the Canadian influence in Siberia, the foodstuffs that were sent.
Oh, yes.
And the canteen. Were actual Canadian people, personnel, involved with
no.
this?
No.
Just the stores?
Yes. And another thing the Canadians did, every man jack of us had a Christmas present. And it was sent by what was then known as the Knights of Columbus. And, well, there's the envelope. I've still got it.
Oh, yes, I see the cover.
That was
yes, it's
Christmas greetings. And that was sent us by the Canadians.
Christmas greetings to our brave soldiers from their Canadian friends.
That's it.
From the National Service Committee.
And they were known as the Knights of Columbus. They were really great.
You also mentioned a little earlier on a travelling church that you saw on the
yes,
railway.
Yes, you have a photograph of it there.
Did you see that yourself?
No. It was pointed out that that's what it was, the travelling church.
And that would have gone along the Siberian, the Trans-Siberian River?
Oh, yes. They were Orthodox Greek.
Was there much evidence of religion in Russia, did you see?
Well, yes, because each time we went to a cathedral, nearly every town seemed to have had its cathedral, the congregations were pretty thick. And you had the peasants and you had the, I'll say the upper crust, and if you like the generals, the army personnel. What struck us, more or less, it was like the height of hypocrisy. All round the church, or rather up, oh, I was going to say the stage, because the back of the church was one mass of brass carvings, the doors, and marvellous paintings on the ceilings. And as the doors opened, I call him the bishop, if you like, he'd come out, and then there'd be two minor priests out of two other doors, and they'd line themselves up beside him. And they'd be holding the Bible, and one would turn the thing over this side, the leaf over this side, the other chap would take and put it down. And you've got three men there, three clergymen, and the bishop would be walking forward, one would be walking backward, naturally, while he was reading the lesson, or reading the text. And the choir would be on your right and left. And the no organ, the choir master would conduct it by tuning fork. By golly, they could sing. They really could.
Why do you think it was hypocritical?
Because these people would be there. Now, the peasants especially, they'd be more or less grovelling to the priest, and as he walked down amongst them, they'd be kissing the hem of his gown and what have you. And yet, they would use language in the context of conversation, which to us would be abhorrent. They didn't know any different. And there was one example quoted to us by an authoritative person to the effect that when the priest was going around and they'd have a bowl of water, one chap would be holding a bowl of water while the priest would be holding a brush, and he'd dip the brush in the water and be blessing the congregation as he come down. And he missed one section, and they queried it. They wanted to know why. They said, "But you haven't brought your offerings." They were from the same village. "But we have nothing to bring. We've no cattle. We've very, very few poultry." "Then bring your poultry." They didn't care a damn whether they lived or starved, as long as they got what they wanted. And one place we were at, in Ekaterinburg, you see all those poor devils lining up for food and what have you. In the evening, the sanitary people would come, and they'd have a circular barrel, oh, easily as high as that picture, that round, on a huge sleigh. And the cover would open at the top. They'd be squared and you'd thrown back. And they'd open the manhole in the centre of your compound and ladle out all the... There was no sewerage. That was the only sewerage they had. And one of the men there one night, we asked him if he couldn't throw either some lime down or chlorodine or something to kill the stell as they were unloading. And they said no, they hadn't got any. They weren't allowed any. And they said, "You'd be surprised at the number of babies that we bring out of these places," because it was had been a girls' college. And the priests, it was a case of like Rasputin preached, sin for salvation.
So the priests would have been the fathers of these babies?
Yeah. And so that they wouldn't have any encumbrances, they just got rid of them like that. Now that sounds impossible, doesn't it?
Yes, because the babies went out with the refuse, yeah. The excrement.
Yeah. That another thing. The peasants were so unutterably ignorant that they'd no idea of right from wrong. Now, in a peasant's house, if we could call it a house, we'd call it a hovel, the stove would be a square effect. And in the winter, the family sleep round the stove with their feet poking underneath the stove to get the warmth. Now, this may sound incredible and may sound an exaggeration, but believe me, it is not. Father would consult with daughter, son would consult with mother, and they wouldn't know the difference that things happened. And in the summer, now, this is an eyewitness account. The chap spoke perfect English. In the summer, in the evenings, of course there was no such things as cinemas or anything like that for out there. They would, all the village would gather around in the square, And a girl would be placed on her back with a makeshift pillow for her head. And she'd be blindfolded. Now, mother and father's looking on and all that, brothers and sisters. And a man would have sexual intercourse with her. And she'd have to guess who it was. Now, it's quite believable in the fact of what we had experienced ourselves when we were recruiting for Admiral Kolchak's army. We recruited 900 men. And we had them in the bathroom, and we had to scrub them, and we scrubbed them with paraffin first. And then they had a damn good shower, and well, I don't suppose they'd been as clean since they were born. And we fitted them out with uniforms. Now, of those 900, we had to kick out 700 of them. All with VD. Well, was it any wonder? When you... and that's why we were threatened with dire consequences if we consorted with any Russian woman. And when we were coming back from Ekaterinburg back to Vladivostok, women, girls, were offering their bodies if they'd allow us to bring them down on the train. More than we dare do. No. I know it was heartbreaking at the time to have to refuse these young maids, shall we say, freedom. But when they were be prepared to sell themselves for that, you can imagine what it was like. Because every time we stopped, every break between the carriages, that had to be examined to make sure there was none of these girls riding on the buffers.
Were there ever cases when the British soldiers, you know, went with the Russian women?
No. They were afraid. Because it was so rampant at that time that you wouldn't... what we were supplied with every evening... between 7 and 8 o'clock was unsweetened lime juice. And it was to prevent, as put it as politely as I could, men having a sexual urge. It killed that. And which was a good thing, really, because the risk was too great. And if I might break off at a tangent for a moment, when I eventually got home and my dad worked on the railway, and he was saying about the train loads of wounded that they were bringing in and what have you, and fellas coming back from France and Germany with VD. And I said, look, Dad, before you go any further, I'm quite prepared now or first thing in the morning to go down to the doctor's and have a thorough examination. I said, because I can tell you, no, I'm as clean as a newborn babe. Oh, thank God, he said. That was his very words.
Yeah, it seems to have been quite a prevalent thing in World War One, this...
Yes.
BD, yes. The fear of getting it.
Well, you see, all the outcome of promiscuity, isn't it? But, no.
Could I now go back to what you were saying about Kolchak's army?
Yeah.
And the task the British had for recruitment? Could you tell me more about this? Was that one of the main jobs you were doing, and was this in Omsk?
Yes. I won't say it was one of the main jobs, insofar that we didn't realise we were recruiting these people, you see.
And another thing... What was your brief, then, for this?
The only thing that we knew was that... through some agency or the other, possibly our officers, recruiting these people, or whether they, the populace themselves, thought it was a good way of getting, we say, a good square meal, join the army at that time. Because everything was very, very scarce out there. And we weren't actually there for that purpose, as far as I'm aware, because we had no action in it until we'd got these crowds turning up, and they had to be deloused, I'll put it that way, and all their stuff was burnt. And when we fitted them out with uniforms and that, and they had their medical tests, and that's what was found.
What uniforms would they have had? Would these have been provided by the British?
No, I should think they must have been the same type of uniform that we were wearing, and they were Canadians. That is, the khaki suits were lined. All our suits were lined. And then we had monkey jackets, that we called them. We were sheepskin coats. And we had snowshoes. And as I say, we used to have three pairs of socks and a pair of thick stockings on the top.
But the Russian recruits, they would have worn the same outfit.
They would have had
yours.
The same, yes.
I see. What happened to the 200? You were saying how out of 900...
Oh,
they
went... contact must have been made, I think, because they went into Kolchak's army.